Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, March 23rd, 2025. First, Ocean Plant Cell Discovery Might Revolutionize Farming by Ari Daniel. From NPR, broadcast on March 13th, 2025. A new part of an ocean plant cell has been discovered that might revolutionize farming one day. The structure can take nitrogen and convert it into the ingredient that helps all organisms grow. The host, A. Martinez. We are going to zoom in on this next story, actually zoom way in. A team of scientists looking at a microscopic mystery recently won a top prize from the publisher of the journal Science. Reporter Ari Daniel has more on their discovery and how it might revolutionize farming. Ari Daniel, byline. John Zaire, a now retired microbial ecologist from UC Santa Cruz, was confronted with the puzzle. On research cruises while testing seawater, he and his colleagues kept finding the same fragment of DNA in the ocean. But when they went to look for the organism it came from, no one ever managed to see it. John Zaire. Every time we would get these samples, we looked through the microscope and there's nothing there. Daniel. And yet, the DNA was everywhere, in the open ocean, along the coast, in the tropics, the Arctic. It also appeared to have a special and rare function of taking nitrogen from the surroundings, which living things need to survive, and turning it into a form that could then be fashioned into proteins and DNA. Usable nitrogen like this is pretty scarce. Zaire. That's why we add it as fertilizer in agriculture. Same is true in the oceans. It's in short supply over wide regions of the ocean. Ari Daniel. Up until now, the ability to transform nitrogen was a feat scientists thought only certain kinds of bacteria and other simple microbes could pull off. But here's what this puzzle wound up revealing. Some 140 million years ago, a free-living bacteria that could grab all the nitrogen it wanted out of the water it was swimming in fused with an ancient algal cell, says Tyler Cole, a biologist with UC Santa Cruz. Tyler Cole. One cell engulfs another and then doesn't digest it, but rather incorporates it into its own body. Over time, the bacteria jettisoned some of its genes, says Ari Daniel. The algae became dependent on the nitrogen it was receiving until eventually each one could no longer live without the other. Cole, so the process of two species becoming one. Daniel, this is a lot like what gave rise to the mitochondria and chloroplast, but in this case, it led to a cellular structure that could transform nitrogen into something useful. The researchers called it the nitroplast, and it's responsible for pumping significant amounts of nitrogen into the global ocean. Solving this microscopic riddle took years. The first clue was that whatever had produced this fragment of DNA was missing all sorts of genes. To survive, Zaire figured it had to be getting help from another life form. He says, because it lives with somebody else who can provide those things. Daniel, he was right. That somebody else turned out to be a kind of single-celled algae that looks like a teensy soccer ball. The team partnered with the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory to use X-rays to peer inside that soccer ball. Structural biologist Valentina Loconte was struck by what she saw. Inside the alga, I found the little cell, she says. Daniel. This little entity, what appeared at the time to be a little cell, was the oddball source of all that DNA in the ocean. Loconte, it means that the two organisms are really living together. Daniel, Tyler Cole pored over the inner workings of both. He found the little guy's missing genes were housed in the big cell, and the big cell received nitrogen from the little guy. That is, the two needed one another. Coal. And at that point, it makes it very difficult to call these two different organisms if their genomes are so intermingled. Daniel. Instead, this was a single organism. The little guy was actually the nitroplast, a component of the bigger algal cell. This nitroplast allowed the more complex organism, so not a simple microbe, it had a nucleus, to capture its own nitrogen. Doug Capone. It's been in plain sight, but to get the details that finally made the leap of faith, wow, that's really cool. Daniel. Doug Capone is a biological oceanographer at the University of Southern California who wasn't involved with the discovery. He says the nitroplast could be introduced someday to crops to allow them to convert their own nitrogen without relying on external fertilizer. Capone. This provides a model system for how one might integrate the nitroplast into an agriculturally important crop. It's one of the holy grails of biotechnology, says John Zehr, the ability to engineer plants that could snatch nitrogen out of the air and use it to grow without any of the pollution, energy, or expense that current fertilizers require. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel. And that was heard on Morning Edition, NPR's broadcast on March 13, 2025. Ocean Plant Cell Discovery Might Revolutionize Farming, by Ari Daniel. And just 4 days after this report was filed, an exciting event. NASA astronauts' 9-month orbital odyssey ends in a splashdown. Sonny Williams and Butch Wilmore finally made it home to Earth after a 17-hour trip aboard a SpaceX capsule. Reported by Kenneth Chang and Thomas Fuller, published March 17th and updated March 18th, 2025. They set off to spend 8 days at the space station. The trip lasted 9 months. On Tuesday, two NASA astronauts who had been in orbit since June, Sonny Williams and Butch Wilmore, splashed down in calm azure waters off the coast of the Florida Panhandle, concluding a saga that had captivated the country since last summer. Ms. Williams and Mr. Wilmore blasted off in June 2024 for the International Space Station on their test flight of Starliner, a Boeing spacecraft that was to provide NASA with another option outside of SpaceX to carry astronauts to and from orbit. But the Starliner experienced problems with its propulsion system, prompting NASA to send it back to Earth with no crew aboard. It was a SpaceX capsule, the Crew Dragon, that brought them back from space on Tuesday. The spacecraft detached from the space station just after 1 a.m. Eastern Time and then traveled back to Earth, slowing down for more than 17,000 miles an hour before deploying 4 large parachutes that gently plopped the spacecraft into the water just before 6 p.m. Minutes later, as recovery teams inspected the capsule, a pod of curious dolphins circled, a playful, terrestrial, welcoming party. Once the capsule had been hoisted onto a ship, the door was opened and the beaming astronauts were extracted from the spacecraft. After months of weightlessness, their bodies still adjusting to the pull of gravity, they were lifted onto gurneys. They all looked very healthy, Steve Stitch, the manager of NASA's Commercial Crew Program, said during a news conference after the splashdown. They all looked like they were feeling about normal for the landing and recovery phase, where their body is trying to readapt. Returning with the two astronauts were Nick Hague, the commander of this mission known as Crew 9, and Alexandra Gorbunov, a Russian astronaut. The 4 astronauts were scheduled to fly back to NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston, where they were to remain briefly until doctors let them go home. They'll rejoin their families in the next day or so, Mr. Stitch said. The mission both underlined the dominance of SpaceX in the growing field of private spacecraft and the comparative woes of Boeing. But as with so many things in the early stages of the current administration, the astronauts' return was tinged with politics. The president suggested in January that the Biden administration had stranded the astronauts, and Elon Musk, who is the founder of SpaceX, said this month that the Biden administration had rejected his offer to bring them home sooner. But Bill Nelson, who served as the administrator of NASA during the Biden administration, said that NASA never heard about Mr. Musk's offer and that the agency's decisions were based on what made the most sense for the operations of the space station. On the basis that there was no contact with NASA, there was no political consideration from NASA's point of view, Mr. Nelson said. About a half hour after the astronauts returned, the White House posted on social media, "Promise made, promise kept." The president pledged to rescue the astronauts stranded in space for 9 months. However, it has been NASA's plan since August for the Crew 9 mission to return with Ms. Williams and Mr. Wilmore around this time frame. An hour after the White House post, Mr. Musk offered celebratory congratulations on X to teams at SpaceX and NASA for another safe astronaut return. But the astronauts also disputed the notion that they were stuck in space. "It's work, it's fun, it's been trying at times, no doubt," Mr. Wilmore said in an interview from the space station last week with the New York Times. "But stranded? No. Stuck? No. Abandoned? No." At the station, Ms. Williams and Mr. Wilmore had to adjust to their unexpectedly long stay. From the start, they were short of clothes because their suitcases had been left off the Starliner to make room for a replacement pump to fix the toilet. They relied on spare clothing in the space station. NASA sent up their clothes and other personal items a couple of months later on a Northrop Grumman cargo ship. Such robotic cargo ships arrive periodically from Russia and the United States, bringing food, supplies, and experiments. According to a summary published by NASA, astronauts at the space station, which orbits about 250 miles above the Earth, carried out a variety of tasks on the station, including maintenance work and nearly 1,000 hours of scientific research. That included a spacewalk by Ms. Williams and Mr. Wilmore to swab the outside of the space station to see if Earth microbes could survive and maybe even thrive in space. Ms. Williams also helped set up an experiment to study how microbes produced nutrients like vitamins, and also conducted research on how weightlessness affected microscopic organisms that could be used to make food and medicines, NASA said. The astronauts were able to connect with friends, family, and the public on the ground. They had access to email and video calls. They tried to put a positive spin on the whole experience. "You get a little bit more time to enjoy the view out the window," Ms. Williams said in the interview with the Times last week. Not everything they saw was pleasing. From space, Mr. Wilmore saw Hurricane Beryl, which hit Houston last July. The storm damaged the roof of his home. The astronauts also saw the smoke from the Los Angeles fires in January. Mr. Wilmore, who has a wife and two children, missed most of his younger daughter's senior year of high school and his elder daughter's sophomore year in college. He said his younger daughter was tough, but she also told him, "I didn't know how much I needed you until you were gone." And this report, NASA Astronauts' 9-Month Orbital Odyssey, ends in a splashdown, was posted on March 18, 2025, in the New York Times. And what about that terrestrial welcoming committee? Pod of dolphins greets NASA astronauts. The marine mammals swarmed around the recovery team and capsule, welcoming home the astronauts shortly after they splashed down off Florida's Gulf Coast. By Sarah Ruberg, posted in the New York Times on March 18, 2025. SpaceX and the Coast Guard work together to try to keep civilian boaters away from returning spacecraft after astronauts splashed down in the water. But on Tuesday night, they could not do anything about a pod of curious dolphins. A handful of the marine mammals swam up to a recovery boat that was set to lift the crew Dragon Freedom to its deck and surfaced from the clear blue waters. "Wow, we got a cute little pod of dolphins. It wasn't just one or two," said Kate Tice, an engineering manager at SpaceX who was commentating on the company's video stream. As the dolphin's dorsal fins bobbed, she said that the team working on retrieving the capsule was getting quick assists from the honorary part of the recovery team, those dolphins. Dolphins are generally social and playful marine mammals and often travel in groups or pods. The most common species near Florida's Gulf Coast are bottlenosed dolphins, according to the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. Although it was not clear which species was circling the SpaceX crews on Tuesday. Todd Speakman, a field biologist with the National Marine Mammal Foundation, said while he couldn't definitively identify the dolphin species, he said it was likely a Stenella dolphin, which are often found near the Gulf Coast. He said he wasn't surprised that the pod approached the capsule shortly after splashdown. "With there being that much activity, they're just curious animals, so they're going to come check it out," Mr. Speakman said, adding that dolphins will often swim around their research ships. It's not the first time wildlife have visited astronauts just after they returned to Earth. In 2021, photographers captured a lone dolphin swimming near the recovery boats headed to pick up the Dragon spacecraft used for SpaceX Crew 1 mission. But an Orlando news station reported that the animal didn't stick around for the capsule's splashdown. Sarah Ruberg, who reported on this terrestrial welcoming party, covers breaking news and is a member of the 2024-2025 class of Times Fellows, a program for journalists early in their careers. Also from the New York Times, posted on March 18, 2025, and written by Claire Moses. Williams and Wilmore are not the first astronauts to be delayed in space. From a spacecraft's coolant leak to the disintegration of the Soviet Union, astronauts have gotten stuck in space for a variety of reasons over the decades of human spaceflight. The NASA astronauts Sonny Williams and Butch Wilmore are not the first to stay unexpectedly in space much longer than planned. Here are some other notable examples. On May 18, 1991, Sergei Krikalev set off into space for a stay at the Mir, the Soviet Union's space station at the time. While he was up there, the Soviet Union disbanded, and he was asked to extend his stay by almost 5 months, in part a result of the country's disintegration and money problems in Moscow. The episode turned him into a bit of a media celebrity, earning him the nickname "the last Soviet citizen." He stayed in space for 313 days, returning on March 25, 1992. In 2003, three astronauts, Ken Bowersox and Donald Pettit, both American, and Nikolai Buterin, a Russian, had to prolong their stay on the relatively new International Space Station by about 3 months. While they were in space, a NASA space shuttle disintegrated as it re-entered Earth's atmosphere and killed all seven astronauts on board in an incident that became known as the Columbia disaster. As a safety measure, NASA suspended its space shuttle flights. Eventually, after more than 5 months in space, the three astronauts landed back on Earth in a Russian capsule in May 2003. Dr. Pettit, now 69, returned to the space station aboard a Russian vehicle last fall for another stay and is scheduled to return to Earth in April of this year. In 2022, the American astronaut Frank Rubio headed to the International Space Station for a 6-month stay. Instead, he stayed just over a year, 371 days, in what became the longest single space flight for a U.S. astronaut. In December 2022, after coolant leaked from the Russian spacecraft that was to be used to bring Mr. Rubio home, his return trip was delayed while a different spacecraft was sent to pick him up, and two Russian astronauts also. Like people serving in the military, you kind of grow up with the mindset of, you have to be ready for the unexpected, he said in an interview last August, because that's a very common thing. And Claire Moses, who reported on other examples on astronauts getting stuck in space for a longer time than planned, is a Times reporter in London, focused on coverage of breaking and trending news. And speaking of life in space, this from the Department of Technology in the January 2025 issue of Science News, a Dune-inspired space suit would keep astronauts hydrated, by Adam Mann. In the science fiction series Dune, the desert-dwelling Fremen of the arid planet Arrakis recycle their body's moisture using specially designed outfits called stillsuits. Inspired by such imaginings, a new prototype space suit converts astronauts' urine into drinkable water, researchers report in the journal Frontiers in Space Technologies. I've been a fan of the Dune series for as long as I can remember, says Sophia Etlin, a space medicine and policy researcher at Cornell University. Building a real-life stillsuit was always a bit of a dream. While suited up in space, astronauts relieve themselves into a multi-layered diaper-like garment that contains a super-absorbent polymer. But the garment is uncomfortable, leaks, and can cause urinary tract infections. Current spacesuits also incorporate an in-suit drinking bag, or IDB, that carries less than a liter of water. Astronauts sometimes go for 8-hour spacewalks, which often include enormous amounts of physical exertion, Etlin says. NASA's future Artemis missions to the moon will probably see explorers spending at least that much time or longer on the lunar surface, though plans have them carrying IDBs of the same size. Etlin and colleagues designed a new type of undergarment with a collection cup that goes over an astronaut's private parts. Urine is routed into a filtration system that removes salty water from the urine and then uses a pump to take the salt out of that water. The filtered water is enriched with electrolytes and sent into the IDB. The system, powered by a 20.5-volt battery, can purify half a liter of water in 5 minutes. Sweat, which fictional stillsuits also collect, would be easier to filter than urine, Etlin says. But she and colleagues decided to focus on a single waste product for their first prototype. One step at a time, she says. And that article, a Dune-inspired spacesuit would keep astronauts hydrated, comes from the January 2025 issue of Science News. And finally, from the technically fiction section of the January 2025 issue of Science News, Where Are the Flying Cars? By Helen Bradshaw. The year is 2015. Mad scientist Doc Brown has just brought wide-eyed teenager Marty McFly to the future in style, aboard a flying DeLorean. Although the time travelers are out of place, their mode of transportation is not. Cars zip by in the sky. We are now 10 years past the future envisioned in Back to the Future Part 2, and still no flying cars. But aerial automobiles, a mainstay of sci-fi and fantasy stories since the early 1900s, may soon be reality. The technology to make flying cars already exists, says an aerospace engineer at Missouri University of Science and Technology in Roya. And some companies have already flown prototypes. A real-world flying car would most likely be a cross between an airplane and a helicopter. Airplanes need runways, so it would be more practical for a flying car to take off vertically, like a helicopter. Rotating blades would generate lift to bring the vehicle off the ground. Once it's completed takeoff, you can fly like a normal airplane, says Professor Du, the aerospace engineer at Missouri University. Airplane wings would rotate out from the body, allowing for flight with less air resistance than a helicopter experience. Another option is to attach propellers to a flying car's wings. At first, the wings would be tilted upward so that the propellers could lift the vehicle. Once the car takes off, the wings would tilt to lay flat, like those on an airplane, says aerospace engineer Pat Anderson, former director of the Eagle Flight Research Center at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach, Florida. It's like a transformer. Vehicles with rotating blades and propellers don't sound much like the flying cars of science fiction. They don't even sound much like cars. Instead, these vehicles would resemble winged military choppers, like those in the Avatar movies, Anderson says, or real-world winged choppers, like the U.S. military's V-22 Osprey. One of the biggest barriers to people commuting in flying cars is expense. The U.S. company Aleph Aeronautics, for instance, plans to sell personal cars that can drive on roads and take off into the skies. These cars look and function similarly to those in many sci-fi movies, but come with a steep price tag. When they go into production sometime this year, the cars are expected to cost about $300,000 each. For people with more modest bank accounts, a rideshare service for flying cars, something like Uber or Lyft for the skies, may be more likely, Anderson says. Flying Ubers may become common in 10 or 20 years, he predicts. First, aircraft need to be tested over and over for safety. The U.S. Federal Aviation Administration also needs to create regulations for flying cars. In October, the FAA brought the industry closer to liftoff by announcing rules on operating and piloting air taxis. Those regulations pertain to a type of electric vehicle. Because of sustainability, people are kind of in love with batteries, Anderson says. But batteries are heavy and, like those in electric cars, have a limited range. Flying takes a lot of power, especially during takeoff. Current rechargeable lithium-ion batteries would power a flying car ride for only 20 to 30 minutes, Du says. And while a car that runs out of charge can simply pull over, a flying car would fall out of the sky. So Du and many other researchers are trying to improve battery efficiency before flying taxis take off. And where are the flying cars? Appears in the department Technically Fiction in the January 2025 issue of Science News. The following articles were previously broadcast on several shows last fall. From the August 24th, 2024 issue of Science News. Mars rover finds a major surprise. A rock might host signs of life, but can NASA get it to Earth? By Lisa Grossman. NASA's Perseverance rover has bagged its first hint of ancient microbes on Mars. We're not able to say that this is a sign of life, says Perseverance deputy project scientist Katie Stack Morgan of NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, JPL, in Pasadena, California. But this is the most compelling sample we've found yet. The rover, nicknamed Percy, drilled the sample on July 21st from a reddish rock dubbed Chayava Falls. It is the first piece of Mars that Percy has examined that contains organic molecules, the building blocks of life, project scientist Ken Farley of Caltech reported July 25th in Pasadena at the 10th International Conference on Mars. This isn't the first sign of organics on the Red Planet. The Curiosity rover detected organic molecules in Gale Crater in 2014. But scientists have struggled to identify organics since Percy landed in an ancient dried-up lake called Jezero, crater. In 2021, Stack Morgan says, adding to the excitement, the reddish rock is speckled with little white spots with black rims. They look like a tricolored leopard spot, Stack Morgan says. Using instruments to identify the spot's chemical contents, Percy found that the rims contain iron phosphate. On Earth, rings with similar texture and chemistry are associated with ancient microbial life. The chemical reactions that microbes use for energy can also create the rings. The rings don't require life, of course, and that's an important caveat, Stack Morgan says. But based on our experience with similar things on Earth, there's a possibility that life could have been evolved and involved, and these could have a biological origin. The rock has other confusing features that muddy the picture of how it formed. It is shot through with white veins of calcium sulfate. Tiny crystals of olivine, a mineral that forms from magma, permeate these veins. The inclusion of both the spots and these volcanic features in the same rock is a little bit mysterious, Stack Morgan says, as they point to different origins. Figuring out how the rock formed could help tell how likely it is to have had the right conditions and temperatures to host biology. Planetary scientist Paul Byrne of Washington University in St. Louis is circumspect about the finding. Could this truly be a biosignature? Yes, and if it is, then it really is the kind of society-altering discovery that the discovery of truly extraterrestrial life would be, Byrne says. But it's also possible that the spots came from something other than life, in which case all this is an interesting example of water rock chemistry. The only way to find out for sure is to bring the rock home. A big part of Percy's mission is to collect samples from interesting rocks for a future spacecraft to return to Earth for study. But funding uncertainty has put the program, known as Mars Sample Return, on hold. With this sample, the rationale for MSR is strengthened even more, and should, I hope, motivate NASA to commit to pulling off this project sooner rather than later, Byrne says. The rover team is carrying on despite the budget uncertainty. We have a mission to carry out and a job to do. Collecting compelling samples, Stack Morgan says. It can only be our hope that the samples that we collect are compelling enough to justify the cost of Mars Sample Return, or MSR. I think with this exciting sample, that really hits that home. Our second article with Planetary Science News in the same issue is Hidden Lunar Quakes Revealed. The finding may influence future trips to the moon, by Lisa Grossman. A new look at decades-old data from the NASA Apollo missions has uncovered evidence of tens of thousands of previously unrecognized moonquakes. The finding could reveal details about the moon's inner workings and have implications for future human missions. There were more tectonic events on the moon. It's more tectonically active than considered before, says planetary seismologist Keisuke Onodera of the University of Tokyo. By meticulously examining the shapes of seismic waves recorded on the moon, Onodera found 22,000 never-before-seen moonquakes, he reported in the July issue of Journal of Geophysical Research, Planets. In the 1960s and 1970s, the Apollo missions that landed on the moon brought along two kinds of seismometers, one to measure longer-period seismic waves that originate deep underground, and one to measure shorter-period waves that begin closer to the surface or that carry more energy. The seismometers draw the shape of the waves that shake the ground. Some are squat and dampen quickly, while others are long and taper out. Based on the shapes, scientists can learn about the origins of the quake. Some of those seismometers take data nearly continuously from 1969 through 1977, recording about 13,000 seismic events. But most of the data from the short-period seismometers were so contaminated with other sources of waves, they were almost unusable at the time. These are 50-year-old data that people had to deal with basically by hand, says Siri Nunn, a lunar seismologist who is based in California. You'd print them out on a crappy old dot matrix printer and draw it up by hand. So lunar scientists knew that they were probably missing some moonquakes from that time period, but nobody had actually sat down and cleaned up the data to find out how many, until Onodera turned his attention to it last year. The most surprising thing is I detected 22,000, a much larger number of events than the original data set, Onodera says. The new quakes bring the total known number to 35,000. That's something nobody expected, he says. Onodera looked at the graph of each individual seismic event by eye and categorized them one by one based on shape. Other lunar scientists were impressed by this low-tech meticulousness. It's natural intelligence, I would say, not artificial intelligence, says planetary geophysicist Rafael Garcia of ISAE Supeiro in Toulouse, France. I'm sure it's a large amount of work. He reprocessed everything. Most of the newly identified quakes were from external sources like extreme temperature changes or impacts, including times when NASA deliberately dropped rocket boosters or lunar modules on the moon's surface to see what would happen. But some are shallow moonquakes that reflect motions originating in the upper few kilometers of the moon's crust. These quakes are the ones most likely to give information about the moon's inner workings. Previous studies had identified 28 such quakes over the 8 years of observations. Onodera found 46 more, significantly increasing the total number of known shallow moonquakes. He also found that these shallow quakes seem to be more common in the northern hemisphere, near the Apollo 15 landing site, than near the more southerly Apollo 14 and 16 sites. Gravity data from the NASA GRAIL probes, which smashed into the lunar surface in 2012, showed that solidified magma streams surround the Apollo 15 site as well. The shallow moonquakes may form when the moon's crust contracts around these dense intrusions, Onodera suggests. Getting a better handle on lunar quakes' frequency and strength will be important in planning human trips to the moon and possibly building structures there. Seismic data can help measure the depth of lunar soil, which can set limits for how much shaking lunar habitats need to withstand, and indicate where the safest landing sites might be. Lunar scientists should soon have much more data to work with. NASA and its commercial partners are planning to send a pair of seismometers to the far side of the moon in 2025. And the Chinese Chang'e 7 mission will send a seismometer to the lunar south pole in 2026. It's kind of a golden age for planetary seismology, says Garcia, who is one of the lead investigators for the 2025 mission. From NASA News, liftoff. NASA's Europa Clipper sails toward ocean moon of Jupiter, released on October 14, 2024. A SpaceX Falcon Heavy rocket carrying NASA's Europa Clipper spacecraft lifted off from Launch Complex 39A at NASA's Kennedy Space Center in Florida at 12:06 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time on Monday, October 14, 2024. After launch, the spacecraft plans to fly by Mars in February 2025, then back by Earth in December 2026, using the gravity of each planet to increase its momentum. With help of these gravity assists, Europa Clipper will achieve the velocity needed to reach Jupiter in April 2030. NASA's Europa Clipper has embarked on its long voyage to Jupiter, where it will investigate Europa, a moon with an enormous subsurface ocean that may have conditions to support life. The spacecraft launched at 12:06 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, Monday, October 14th, aboard a SpaceX Falcon Heavy rocket from Launch Pad 39A at NASA's Kennedy Space Center in Florida. The largest spacecraft NASA ever built for a mission headed to another planet. Europa Clipper also is the first NASA mission dedicated to studying an ocean world beyond Earth. The spacecraft will travel 1.8 billion miles, 2.9 billion kilometers, on a trajectory that will leverage the power of gravity assists, first to Mars in 4 months and then back to Earth for another gravity assist flyby in 2026. After it begins orbiting Jupiter in April 2030, the spacecraft will fly past Europa 49 times. Congratulations to our Europa Clipper team for beginning the first journey to an ocean world beyond Earth, said NASA Administrator Bill Nelson. NASA leads the world in exploration and discovery, and the Europa Clipper mission is no different. By exploring the unknown, Europa Clipper will help us better understand whether there is the potential for life not just within our solar system, but among the billions of moons and planets beyond our sun. Approximately 5 minutes after liftoff, the rocket's second stage fired up, and the payload fairing, or the rocket's nose cone, opened to reveal Europa Clipper. About an hour after launch, the spacecraft separated from the rocket. Ground controllers received a signal soon after, and two-way communication was established at 1:13 p.m. with NASA's Deep Space Network facility in Canberra, Australia. Mission teams celebrated as initial telemetry reports showed Europa Clipper is in good health and operating as expected. We could not be more excited for the incredible and unprecedented science NASA's Europa Clipper mission will deliver in the generations to come, said Nikki Fox, Associate Administrator, Science Mission Directorate at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. Everything in NASA science is interconnected, and Europa Clipper's scientific discoveries will build upon the legacy that our other missions exploring Jupiter, including Juno, Galileo, and Voyager, created in our search for habitable worlds beyond our home planet. The main goal of the mission is to determine whether Europa has conditions that could support life. Europa is about the size of our own moon, but its interior is different. Information from NASA's Galileo mission in the 1990s showed strong evidence that under Europa's ice lies an enormous salty ocean, with more water than all of Earth's oceans combined. Scientists also have found evidence that Europa may host organic compounds and energy sources under its surface. If the mission determines Europa is habitable, it may mean there are more habitable worlds in our solar system and beyond than imagined. We're ecstatic to send Europa Clipper on its way to explore a potentially habitable ocean world, thanks to our colleagues and partners who've worked so hard to get us to the day, said Lori Leshin, director, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, or JPL, in Southern California. Europa Clipper will undoubtedly deliver mind-blowing science. While always bittersweet to send something we've labored over for years off on its long journey, we know this remarkable team and spacecraft will expand our knowledge of our solar system and inspire future exploration. In 2031, the spacecraft will begin conducting its science-dedicated flybys of Europa. Coming as close as 16 miles, or 25 kilometers, to the surface, Europa Clipper is equipped with 9 science instruments and a gravity experiment, including an ice-penetrating radar, cameras, and a thermal instrument to look for areas of warmer ice and any recent eruptions of water. As the most sophisticated suite of science instruments NASA has ever sent to Jupiter, they will work in concert to learn more about the moon's icy shell, thin atmosphere, and deep interior. To power those instruments in the faint sunlight that reaches Jupiter, Europa Clipper also carries the largest solar arrays NASA has ever used for an interplanetary mission. With arrays extended, the spacecraft spans 100 feet, or 30.5 meters, from end to end. With propellant loaded, it weighs about 13,000 pounds, or 5,900 kilograms. In all, more than 4,000 people have contributed to Europa Clipper mission since it was formally approved in 2015. As Europa Clipper embarks on its journey, I'll be thinking about the countless hours of dedication, innovation, and teamwork that made this moment possible, said Jordan Evans, project manager, NASA JPL. This launch isn't just the next chapter in our exploration of the solar system. It's a leap toward uncovering the mysteries of another ocean world, driven by our shared curiosity and continued search to answer the question, are we alone? More about Europa Clipper. Europa Clipper's three main science objectives are to determine the thickness of the moon's icy shell, that is, the moon of Jupiter, and its interactions with the ocean below, to investigate its composition, and to characterize its geology. The mission's detailed exploration of the moon Europa will help scientists better understand the astrobiological potential for habitable worlds beyond our planet. Managed by Caltech in Pasadena, California, NASA JPL leads the development of the Europa Clipper mission in partnership with the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory, or APL, in Laurel, Maryland, for NASA's Science Mission Directorate in Washington. The main spacecraft body was designed by APL in collaboration with NASA JPL and NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama, and NASA's Langley Research Center in Hampton, Virginia. The Planetary Missions Program Office at Marshall executes program management of the Europa Clipper mission. NASA's Launch Services Program, based at NASA Kennedy, managed the launch service for the Europa Clipper spacecraft. There is a more than two-hour video of the launch, the preparation, and the response afterward by very enthusiastic scientists who clearly have worked on this mission for years and who have collaborated with a wide array of centers across the United States. This is a long web link, but what's great is that you can not only see it, but you can hear all the commentary, and you can hear the countdown and all the stages of the rocket launch. Here is the website, science.nasa.gov/mission/Europa, which is spelled EUROPA-Clipper/watch-online/. It is well worth a listen. And this article, Liftoff, NASA's Europa Clipper Sails Toward Ocean Moon of Jupiter, was posted by NASA, the National Aeronautic and Space Administration, on October 14, 2024. Continuing with the world of planetary science, this article comes from the September 2024 issue of Scientific American. Moon Spiders: Features Hint at Spacious Underground Moon Caves. Lava plains and volcanic residue on the moon's surface point to the orb's fiery past. What's below, though, remains mostly a mystery. But in a study in the Planetary Science Journal, researchers describe an odd surface feature that supports the presence of underground, cavus-dermed subsurface voids. Each so-called spider formation consists of multiple gullies, the spider's legs, which seem to have formed when lunar soil flowed into a central indentation about 10 meters wide, the spider's body. The researchers spotted the first four spiders hiding almost imperceptibly in a photograph from the powerful cameras on NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, or LRO. The spider legs are almost at the edge of resolution, says the study's lead author, Mikhail A. Kreslovsky, a planetary scientist at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Once they knew what to look for, the scientists found several more spiders, all in Mare, or Sea, Tranquillitatis, a region with a turbulent volcanic past. Brown University planetary geoscientist and study co-author James W. Head says the relatively low lunar gravity likely allowed big bubbles of gas to form in magma, leaving behind subsurface voids. If these voids' ceilings collapsed because of seismic activity, the authors say, inward-flowing surface material would have created the distinctive spider shape. In an earlier study, LRO detected a void extending under a large pit in Mare Tranquillitatis, and researchers have speculated that some of the moon's roughly 300 other known pits have spacious caves below as well. The study authors suspect many more spiders once existed and were erased. There are still lots of micrometeorites that hit the moon's surface, says Nicole Zellner, a planetary scientist and physicist at Albion College in Michigan, who also studies the lunar surface. The upper meter of material is churned by the bombardment. LRO project scientist Noah Petro of NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland says the spider's proximity to other signs of ground disturbances in volcanic deposits called irregular mare patches and the possibility that spiders might have once appeared near pits could suggest the voids are larger than thought or that they're connected underground. Maybe voids are far more extensive than we previously assumed, he adds. Because today's spiders likely formed within the relatively recent geological past, they serve as a warning for future explorers that in certain places on the moon, dangerous caverns may still lurk below the brittle surface. This article posted by Theo Nikotopoulos. It appears in the September 2024 issue of Scientific American. And a postscript. While the word mare means sea in Latin, in astronomy it is a large, flat, dark plain on the moon that is made of basaltic lava. And finally, a review of one of Science News' top 10 science books for 2024. What Will It Take to Defend the World from an Asteroid? A new book examines the tools in humankind's arsenal and what's still needed. In 2022, NASA's DART spacecraft successfully shoved the distant asteroid Moonlet, Dimorphos, off course. The mission tested a potential strategy to deflect any asteroid that might someday threaten Earth. This review by Shi On Kim, posted on November 28, 2024. The book reviewed is How to Kill an Asteroid by Robin George Andrews, published by W.W. Norton and Company. The dinosaurs saw a grisly death at the hands of an asteroid, but who's to say that Earth's modern-day inhabitants won't meet the same fate? Fortunately, scientists are already hard at work to prevent that future. How to Kill an Asteroid by science journalist Robin George Andrews is a deep dive into the extremely badass business of thwarting a destructive asteroid. The book's title is a slight misnomer. As Andrews explains, the best strategy to save the planet from an impending asteroid is not to blow it up in space, though that's a reasonable last-ditch option, but instead to deflect it while it's still far beyond Earth's neighborhood. The physics of diversion is tricky. Which space-faring rocks are harmless, and which ones are a real threat? Will scientists be able to detect and intercept one in time? And if we manage to deflect it, will the rock fragment into a gazillion deadly bullets bound for Earth? Compared with the rest of science exploration, planetary defense has a short history, beginning as a scientific thought exercise in the 1980s and ramping up in earnest in the 1990s. Andrews does an admirable job of packing in details and context about the field. His thorough research brings readers all over the world and across time, from century-past accounts of asteroids striking Earth to recent dress rehearsals of our asteroid preparedness. Enter DART, D-A-R-T, short for the Double Asteroid Redirection Test, which put on trial the world's arguably best concept for a defensive weapon against incoming asteroids. In 2021, the NASA mission hurled a spacecraft toward Dimorphos, a distant asteroid moonlet that poses no threat to Earth, to see whether it could be knocked off course. On September 26, 2022, the spacecraft face-planted onto the moonlet, successfully shoving the space rock off its orbital path. Andrews frames DART's tale as a gripping disaster thriller. An asteroid is hypothetically hell-bent on destroying Earth, and it's up to scientists, superheroes, to save the world. Though full of suspense, the writing is also at times witty and lighthearted. But for all of DART's success, How to Kill an Asteroid presents a somber truth. The DART mission concept is the only tried and tested defensive strategy humankind currently has in its anti-asteroid arsenal. The world sorely needs more. And when it comes to developing a planetary security system, we humans may be our own worst enemy. Indeed, the real challenge isn't in the science, but rather the bureaucratic surveyor, a space observatory and asteroid specialist, whose fate has become uncertain after a crucial budget cut in 2022. The world has also lost a key space sentinel. Besides being an important instrument for space science, the Arecibo Observatory, which collapsed in 2020, was also one of Earth's best watchdogs for suspicious asteroids. Beyond building the instruments to detect and deter cosmic cannonballs, asteroid preparedness also involves taming the geopolitical, social, and economic fallout. Andrews writes, "If an asteroid one day hurtles toward Earth, human fears and foibles may complicate matters. Once skywatchers sound the alarm, humankind's collective anxiety could upend everyday life long before the asteroid makes landfall or is successfully diverted." Experts have floated several doomsday scenarios that the world may need to prepare for. For instance, rampant misinformation may trigger insurance scams and crash stock markets. Countries might jumpstart their nuclear development programs under the guise of flinging weapons at the asteroid. Other nations might take advantage of the chaos to invade their neighbors. The world might see mass migration out of the predicted ground zone. Nevertheless, How to Kill an Asteroid is overall more hopeful than fear-stoking. It reminds us that the world has no shortage of ideas for how to thwart an asteroid strike. And it is a rallying cry for a reinvestment in planetary defense programs to ensure we're ready for the real thing. Scientists are already more than eager to help. And How to Kill an Asteroid was written by Robin George Andrews. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week.